You're listening to TFM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we'll look forward to seeing you there.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Taking all these books?
I thought I'd take some light reading in case I got bored.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Literary Treks. My name is Jonathan Cohn, and I am joined today by my co-host, KC Pettit. KC, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fantastic. I just finished reading this amazing book, and all I want to do is talk about it.
Oh, well, thankfully, you have come to the right place.
Okay.
Hopefully, our audience feels the same.
Yes, hopefully.
So, before we actually get into the book itself, I'm going to tell us where you can find us and contact us. So we'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show. There are many ways for you to do that. The best place to join in the larger conversation is the Babel Conference, our listeners-only group on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose to send to a show and select Literary Treks. That will find its way to us. You can also find the network on X and Instagram at TrekFM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. We also have a dedicated Goodreads group for Literary Treks. Join us there and you can see the books we've read and what's coming up. If you'd like to help us keep all our shows coming to you, you can become a patron of the show at Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. It requires a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. You can even become a producer, a show associate producer of your favorite show, like Casey Pettit and Greg Rosier are for this show, Literary Treks. Again, you can find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. Lastly, please leave us a star rating and a written review wherever you get your podcasts. It's great for us and also helps others find the show. Well, Casey, we don't really have any book news to cover on this episode, so yeah. I figured let's just go straight into the book.
Yep, we'll go into strike it first.
I was gonna say we're going to invade the next section.
Oh, dang, that's good. Yeah, okay, we'll do that. The book we're talking about, we haven't even said it yet, but it is Star Trek: The Original Series, book number 79. So this is like way back when they were doing numbered books, and It is Invasion, book one, First Strike, by Diane Carey. And this is actually the first true crossover between like the original series and kind of the what was then the modern Star Trek series in the books. Like before this, we'd had Star Trek Federation, which had like a TOS plot and a TNG plot, but they never really met, I guess, each other. They influenced each other, but and it was just TOS and TNG. This one actually encompasses TOS, TNG, DS9, and Voyager. So the first like four book crossover event, and like was back in 1996. So a couple
years ago. Had the Shatnerverse not started yet?
The Shatnerverse had not started yet because the only Star Trek Generations, well, I guess Star Trek Generations.
That was 94.
Had come out. But, oh, yeah, you're right. Actually, The Ashes of Eden and The Return, I guess, were both out around this time. The Ashes of Eden probably came out in 95, 96, somewhere in there.
But it's for certainly the first series
right.
That's like, you know, major series to cross over.
Yeah. And it was actually created, the concept was created by John J. Ordrover, who was one of the editors at the time, as well as Diane Carey, who got the job of writing this first book. And we have a history with Diane Carey. She was actually one of the more prolific writers in Star Trek back in the day. And I guess, you know, just to kind of start off this conversation, it's hard not to notice how much of, like, the naval tradition she brings to Star Trek. Like, I mean, we see it in all our books. We know she's, like, well, if you know anything about her, she's kind of a, I don't know if she was, like, a Navy brat or anything like that, but, like, she definitely has a fascination with naval history and just that, that kind of, the language that you use and all that kind of stuff. So mm-hmm. I don't know. What do you feel when you read her books, you know, as it relates to that?
Well, this book, I thought personally, the balance was perfect. I loved all the military, like Navy stuff. Even though like this is where it gets like weird, where sometimes the creator of a series is wrong about their own series. Like, I know that like Gene Roddenberry was all about, oh, this isn't a military. They're just, you know, exploring in space, but the way that they operate, they're mm-hmm. essentially a pseudo-military. Like, even if they're not conducting warfare, they're doing the typical stuff. They have the structure that a military has. So to me, it makes sense that she's using that stuff. And I've read a lot of military sci-fi where they go so overboard on the jargon, and you're just like, I don't understand what you're talking about. You have to have a degree in military jargon to understand this. That's not how I felt here. I was like, mm-hmm. I understand everything that she's saying. And so to me, it fit perfectly.
Nice. Yeah, I mean, I think it kind of, she tends to go a little bit overboard, but I'd agree. I think this one struck a better balance than in others of her books. But, you know, and I guess the thing that really struck me is just the way they talk, you know, because, yeah, they've got the ranks, they've got that structure, like you're saying. But mm-hmm. I guess I'm just glad that she didn't have, I mean, I guess Kirk did even call people during the series, he'd call men and women Mr., but I'm actually right. surprised she didn't do that here, but I guess I'll say, like, yeah, I feel like it felt overboard to me, but it also didn't take anything away for me, because it did, even though it felt a little unnatural sometimes for them to talk, like, referring to stuff about midships and which came up a lot, but also just the repeating back of orders, which we just don't see on TV as much, which is fine because we don't want to see just everybody repeating back orders all the time.
Also, but it's probably a time issue. Like, on TV, right. you have very limited, you know, time, whereas in a book, you can afford to show the realism of the repeats.
Right. And I mean, this isn't like a Tom Clancy novel or anything, you know, so it really...
That's right. We could be a lot worse on the terminology, man.
Right, yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I just thought it, you know, it's just an interesting thing that she brought to the Star Trek novel verse that other, I don't know of any of the other authors that have ever done anything like that.
I don't know. I will say, so first of all, I was actually a little bit apprehensive going into this book because I had been the one that suggested that we do the Gateway Saga last year.
Oh, yeah.
And that one, I would describe the experience as mixed mm-hmm. to negative. Like, there were some parts I liked of the series, but when I think about it overall, it left it kind of a sour taste in my mouth. And so, because of that, I was just super nervous, and we were committing to a 4-book series, and I was just like, man, I don't know. And also, it was Diane Carey who had written not our favorite book in the Gateway Saga. And right. so I was a little bit apprehensive, and I read almost the entire book in one sitting. And I would have read it in one sitting if I hadn't had to stop for something that happened. But like, I was just breezing through this book. And this book has, to me, a propulsiveness to it. Like, the story is moving fast. And this book has some of the best pacing of a Star Trek book I've read in a long time. And so, like, I felt there weren't wasted chapters. Like, sometimes you read some books and you're like, all right, like, I get why you're doing that for the character, but I feel like mm-hmm. that's just kind of filler or something. To me, every chapter in here advanced the plot and characters at the same time and worked really well.
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, it's... As with some of these books, like with Gateways, I had read that years and years ago and didn't remember it enough to maybe steer us away from that one. This is one that I read years ago. I don't really remember anything much about it, but I remembered I liked it enough that I was like, okay, we gotta read these for literary treks. And it's funny because when I first started reading it, we basically pick up immediately after the episode of the original series called Friday's Child, where they've met the Capellans on the planet Capella. Yeah. And they're actually fighting with the Klingons to protect the Capellans, protect their territory and everything. And, you know, this whole battle with the Klingons, I was like, what are we doing here? But at the same time, it was like you said, I like the word you use, propulsive. Like it moved and I wanted to keep going. I wanted to find out what was going to happen. And I mean, it was really just a really good way to set up the Klingons as kind of the enemy, but also the enemy that we now have to, or will eventually have to, come to terms with to fight a bigger enemy. And I just really liked the way that was set up. Like it was a true battle, something we wouldn't normally see in the original series. It was more like it felt like movie era Klingons, but set in the original series. Like they don't really make reference to the forehead ridges or not or anything like that. But it was just a really well done, got us in the mindset that, you know, of the Klingons as enemies, and kind of it played with our trust a little bit as the book went on, because it's like we're fighting them and now we have to work with them. And just, I don't know, really well done. Again, it was like it threw me off because I was like, I don't know what we're doing here, but it was just a really impactful way to start the book.
Well, I'll say that, especially towards the beginning, with like the whole battle on the planet with the Klingons and the Federation, this is probably the highest compliment I can pay something. It reminded me, in a good way, of the Prey trilogy.
Uh-huh.
And because that's all about the Klingons, and there's a lot of action. It's also propulsive. It's also got misunderstandings and stuff, and it's got mysterious horned creatures. And so there was so much that just made me think of that. And I was like, and in a lesser book, I would have been like, it's better there, which it kind of is. I think still better in Prey. But this was, I was enjoying all of those comparisons. And the book feels like it's pulling from a lot of different things. For instance, the opening scene to me was clearly inspired. The opening scene of all the weird stuff happening and then the Klingon ships firing on the Fury's ship. Mm-hmm. And failing and stuff. To me, that was clearly a motion picture opening reference.
Definitely.
And I thought that she did such a good job. In fact, there's one point where they're like, there's a cloud around it. I was like, okay, that's just the motion picture. But I was going with it. And then you have, I was loving seeing it from the Klingons' perspective. Mm-hmm. And in the motion picture, you don't really get to see like all their thought processes. All you're saying is fire on them. It's very simplistic. Here you get General Kellan thinking through his orders and thinking through everything with his men and just having some really complex thoughts, which I loved. And then when he is on Zenner's ship the second chapter, and he gets pulled back, instantly he says, "Why'd you pull me off the ship? You should have been." It reminded me of Undiscovered Country when when Kirk and McCoy get pulled off of the Klingon prison planet, and he's like, "Why did you pull us off? We were about to find out who's behind all this."
I think. Yeah, you're spot on with like the motion picture. Like, I definitely felt that, just like this ominous thing happening. And actually, yeah, with Kellan, he was such a good character in general, because he wasn't your typical Klingon that's just a brute. Like, I'm going to go, the Klingon captain or whatever was on the planet, you know, when they were fighting him, just because he wanted to fight Kirk. Kellen was a deeper character. Like, he was, like, specifically, I mean, she all but calls it out in the book about how different he is as a Klingon from anybody. Like, he's known around the quadrant for his like patience and his the way he thinks through things. He's kind of a strategist in that way. And yeah, like, I think him, a character like him being the one to be the first one to see these, you know, kind of demon entities, I think worked well because he was, I mean, by that point, I mean, yeah, we're only a few chapters in and he's already established as a character that, like, okay, if he's scared of this, then this is something we should be scared of. Not because he's some, like, feared warrior or anything, but because he's such a respected warrior, I guess, and somebody that is kind of a good, you know, Klingon equivalent of Kirk. You know, somebody with a kind of a cool head on his shoulders, but also, but still Klingon, I guess.
And one thing that I loved about his journey was that it works for the audience in one way, because him, you already are kind of interested in him in the first two chapters with him being abducted and then him thinking things through with his men. And then when he sees, if we're going to need a demon to fight the demon ship, we need to have Kirk. And I was like, ooh, that works really well. I like that thought process.
Yeah.
But then when he goes and he negotiates the truce and he negotiates for them to just leave the planet, like the Klingons, like they're like, we're just abandoning this. This is a lost cause.
Right.
Oh, well, we lost troops. Oh, well. It also works to the audience to underscore the fear that he has, because he is willing to give up an entire planet to get Kirk's help, not to get like anything else in exchange. All he's getting is Kirk saying, I'll send the Enterprise out there and see what we can do. And he's giving up a whole planet. That shows how scared this makes him. And it sells the potential threat of the invaders. And this is probably something that, you know, we could just wait to the end of the podcast to talk about. But to tie the themes together at the different times, I think I want to pull in something from the end. Kellen serves as an opposite character arc to Zenner, the captain of the Fury ship.
Yeah.
So Kellen is a character who has kind of these instincts that you are meant to think are wrong. And those instincts are, this is an alien ship. It's invading us. We got to destroy it.
Right.
And this is Star Trek. You're supposed to side with Kirk on helping out the aliens. You're supposed to side on the let's find the peaceful route. And by the end of the book, Kellen turns out to have been correct in his instincts, just wrong in the way that he carried himself.
Right.
Whereas you have Zenner, who is a character who is has these instincts of these, I forgot what the word, was it like agnosticism? This kind of, he just kind of doesn't believe in this mythology. And his instincts turn out to be somewhat correct, but he's wrong in that he should not be fighting them, that they could find a peaceful solution. And so both of them have the correct instincts, go about things in a different way, and you go from the book setting you up to sympathize with the alien and to think, oh, you stupid Klingons are just being stupid Klingons, to go, Kellen was right. And I loved that, because that's a bold move for a Star Trek novel.
Yeah.
And I think it's hard to do, and it worked.
Yeah. Well, wow. That's, I mean, I think my mind just blew right out of my head with that one. I just, you know, I hadn't really thought about it that way, because I guess, yeah, the whole time we're following Kirk, you know, and he's doing what we expect him to do and trying to be friends with Zenner, like not go into something assuming that they're enemies. And again, like, we saw Kellen on the ship, and he was terrified before he even saw anybody. He just had that feeling. while he was on the ship that this is not a good place, and then starts seeing the skulls, feels like people are watching him, and then he starts actually seeing the aliens, and there's just this like kind of intrinsic fear within him, just the fear response that's just like, this is, you know, everything I was told as a child, you know, to fear. Kirk doesn't feel that. I think he understands it just when he meets with Zenner and the crew of the Fury ship, but still tries to take that like positive outlook, like, you know, kind of innocent until proven guilty, or, you know, whatever, like kind of saying like, yeah, I see where, you know, there's beings with horns and wings and hoofs and, you know, whatever, like that. Yeah, I can see the resemblance, but, you know, these are just people that have been kind of nursing a millennia old wound. You know, 5,000 years they said that they were cast out of this area, and he's like, you know what, like we're intelligent beings, let's share the space or whatever, and just trying to, you know, kind of almost Pollyanna his way through it and say it's going to be great, we're going to be friends, and I'm not going to judge you based on how you look, when maybe he should have been doing just that, like, but it's never been Starfleet's way to fire first and ask questions later.
Right. And, you know, it adds to that complexity for Kellen, because he starts out like, his first instinct is fear. His second instinct is, I need someone who can beat these guys. And he goes to Kirk, and he practically like is like, all right, I'll be your prisoner if you'll, I'll do whatever. And so he becomes his prisoner on his ship, which not prisoner, but guest. Yes. And then as soon as it's obvious Kirk won't do what he assumes Kirk will do, which is blow up the ship, he just turns. Mm-hmm. And I was like, you almost are becoming another character. It's almost like he's turning into his base instincts / yeah. He's just letting his, you know, his prejudice take the better of him. And you feel, man, you are just a terrible Klingon. and you feel Kirk... You know, you feel emboldened to support Kirk because of how much of a reaction Kellen has. I think that if Kellen had been like, well, I disagree, but I will let you do your, you know, Enterprise work, yeah, you would have been like, all right. But because Kellen is so vehemently disagreeing, you're like, I need Kirk to win. I need Kirk, yeah, to prove that this can work so that we can show this stupid Klingon that he's wrong. And that's a really effective way of getting the audience on board with your main characters.
Yeah.
And speaking of things that made like that were effective, this book does something that is, I think, really creative, which is it incapacitates Spock, yeah, without writing him out of the book.
Yes. That was actually, yeah, really smart. It gets him off the bridge, but not completely out. And it shows Kirk having to, it shows, I guess, how much Kirk relies on Spock, and even the way that he was taken out of the story. I mean, it was in part of the battle at the beginning of the book, and it's not one of those things that felt super out of place. Like, he just, oh, Spock's got a really bad cold this week, and so he's going to spend some time in sick bay. It was like a legitimate, right, reason, and, you know, we could see still how much Kirk and Spock rely on each other, but mostly how much Kirk relies on Spock, and it's almost trusts the rest of the crew less because of that. Like, and he realizes, I've got to let some of these people do their jobs.
And also, it's a thematic tie to the end, because at the beginning of the book, Kirk makes a decision to wait to have Spock go get medical help, and that ends up being detrimental to Spock. If he had like immediately sent him up with Bones, he probably would have been way, way better earlier.
Right.
But because he keeps him down there, because he trusts Spock so much, it ends up hurting him, Spock, and it also hurts the crew, because they are now down without their help. And at the end of the book, he has spent so much time delaying the inevitable of firing back and destroying the alien, or the Fury ship. And he keeps delaying because he's trusting that it'll work out. And then he goes too far, and it ends up hurting not only Kirk's crew, but it also hurts the ones that he was trying to help out, being the aliens. And so it's like a thematic. His mistake with Spock is the same mistake that he makes at the end of the book. And I really like when stories can do that, where they make a small mistake at the beginning, and then that's the seed for the big mistake they'll make later on.
Yeah, and he kind of makes mistakes throughout, and he keeps trying to learn from them. And in some ways he does. Like he, even with McCoy, when McCoy was captured on the Fury ship and they were going to burn him alive, basically burn him at the stake. You know, Kirk is trying to figure out how to get him out of there, but also knows that because he's acted, I want to say without thinking, because that kind of is like, he's not thinking things all the way through. Like he realizes that like, if he's got any hope of making things work with Zenner, that he kind of has to potentially let McCoy die. I mean, we know that's not going to happen, but even still, like later on the bridge, he continues to make mistakes of Spock, you know, shows up of his own accord, kind of gets himself out of sick bay by lying, which Vulcans, of course, never do.
Which was so funny.
It was a good scene.
I actually read that the line where he says those subsection C, and it's Kirk says there is no subsection C, and Spock says, but Nurse Chapel does not know that.
Yeah.
And I believe it would embarrass her if we were to inform her. So let's just not.
And then we find out that she's like all upset anyways because. But, you know, and like, and through that too, like, because all of a sudden stuff starts happening, Spock is trying to be coy and stay on the bridge to help out. And Kirk is kind of letting him, he's like, I need to send him back to sick, even orders him back to sick bay, but then gets distracted and, you know, like, but he kind of continues to make the same mistakes and, you know, more crew are dying and, you know, it really takes a lot to push him into fighting, which is kind of a little, I don't know if it's out of character for Kirk, but it's definitely, he felt a little bit more like a Picard in this way of just like, no, we can't fight, we've got to talk our way out of it, because, you know, Kirk was always the, not guns blazing, but just kind of the more maverick captain, and Picard was kind of the negotiator.
He is, but I think it goes back to the idea that he just wants to prove Kellen wrong with this. He just wants to prove that the Federation way is the way to do this.
Yeah.
I think he would have been much less hesitant if it was if he didn't have to deal with the Klingons there. If it was just, oh, the Federation just happened upon this alien ship, he may not have been so determined to be correct that they could do it peacefully.
Well, and that kind of actually then harkens, I guess, forward to the premiere episode of Star Trek Discovery, when Michael Burnham is like, we've got a fire on the Klingons. And Georgiou is like, no, we can't. We don't. Starfleet never fires first. And, you know, kind of then Discovery happened because of all that, I guess, but yeah, kind of, you know, you get people on their kind of high moral ground in the Federation and Starfleet and everything, and in this case it makes things worse for three more books, apparently.
Yeah, I really liked the dynamic that Kirk had with Zenner, and the way that he's kind of almost starting to win Zenner over, and he realizes that Zenner is, you have the Gnostic and Zenner, and then I forgot the name.
Garamanis.
I'm blanking right now. Garamanis, that's it. Garamanis, who is the zealot, and Garamanis has been in the priesthood, the zealot, his whole life, and it's just, he's something he really cares about. And to Zenner, it's almost like he just wants to prove Garamanis wrong.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think there's a saying that says, what's the one person who's more dangerous than a lifelong zealot? And the answer is a zealot who just converted. And that's what happens with Zenner here at the end. And I loved the pain that brings to Kirk.
Yeah.
I mentioned earlier that I had to stop reading a few scenes before the end. I had to stop reading when I got to, because I had to go do something, but I read all the way up to the scene where he calls over on the ship and Zenner is, calls back and Kirk starts with is, you read the files, didn't you? And Zenner says, yes, I did. And I was wrong. Garamanus was right. We must destroy you. And this is not a visual medium. This is a literary medium. But I can just feel, like, the music that would be playing, the ominous, the characters. Like, this is it. Like, it's Star Wars when the character's eyes would turn yellow because they're now a Sith. This is the I am becoming the villain now, and you just mess with the wrong guy type situation.
Yeah.
And I loved that you feel heartbroken, but for Kirk and for everybody, even for Zenner, you feel heartbroken, but you also feel, get the heck out of there, guys.
Yeah. Well, at that point, they should have known. I mean, Kirk's still trying to save his own butt, like, because, and that, I feel like that was another mistake that Kirk made, was hiding, I hesitate to use the word the truth, but, you know, because these are all mythological beings in, you know, human history, Vulcan history, or Andorian, Orion, like Klingon, like all of the races, like, had these beings, like, in their mythologies. And that's where they started calling them the Furies, is because that's from Earth, like Norse mythology or Druidic. Or no, it was Norse mythology or something. Or no, I can't.
Did we ever get their official name? I didn't catch it. If
the
we
Klingons
did,
started by calling them the Havoc.
Right. Okay. I knew the Klingons called them that, but I knew they weren't. I knew that's not what they were called.
And I think Spock goes through a few different names, like the Vulcans call them, that the Klingons call them, that the Andorians, like, and then they come to the humans and start describing the human characters or whatever of the Furies. And that's kind of, I mean, because we're a human audience, we stick with that, and it's a good name.
I hope that, I mean, you probably won't remember, I hope that in the sequel books that they reveal a name that they use, a name that the alien species calls itself, because while Furies works for us, it's so connected to the mythological elements of it that I'm like, I really need to know what their name is so that we could say this is their. It's kind of like how characters get frustrated that we call them 8 species 8472. Yes, that's what we call them, but what is their official name? That is their species name. That's kind of how I feel. We never know on that.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that we'll find out here.
Yeah, and I don't remember that, but I do remember that, like, they're referred to as the Furies for a while, like, or, I mean, through the rest of the books. In fact, the final book, the Voyager one, is called
The Final Fury. That's right. Yeah. That's true.
So I'm curious about that myself, too, because I liked the Havoc. I think that was a pretty cool name. But
that was a cool name.
Yeah.
I was worried at the beginning that they were going to set this up to be a mistaken identity or a mistake issue. Like, because this happens a lot in Star Trek, where it's like, it looks like it's going to be this major big deal, and oh, really, we can get all along.
Yeah.
And no, the series is living up to the title. This is an invasion, and it is not going to be pretty when they come back.
No.
And I do think it actually works really well that this book is set during the TOS time frame, but the next three are all during the same era of TNG, DS9, and Voyager. So it seems plausible that it's like, all right, they sent the message back that, hey, this is the real place. These are the people we have to kill. And then it's like, all right, maybe they'll take 90, 80 years, however long it takes till the next books to regroup. And then you have boom, 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 three books that are back to back to back in the timeline.
Yeah.
So I think that works really well for this series.
Well, I think it works well, too, because, I mean, they, rather than being some alien species that comes from another galaxy and they've just come through some, you know, transgalactic portal or something like that, they say that they're coming from the opposite side of the galaxy, which we know to be the Delta Quadrant, which then sets it up perfectly for the Voyager book. You know, like, obviously they're going to find something there. And I really, man, like, the mystery, I guess, of this book was set up so well because of how the journey that we go on with these characters, you know, that we've been talking about here, because we have this opening battle with the Klingons, and then we have this ship show up that just terrifies Kellan, the Klingon, out of his mind. And then when Kirk meets him, like, yeah, we start to like Zenner. We don't like Garamanis as much because he's the zealot and Zenner's the agnostic one. But, I mean, their story is, you're kind of sympathetic to it because, yeah, you know, they were basically banished from this side of the galaxy 5,000 years ago. And they've been stewing in this, especially the zealots like Garamanis, for 5,000 years. And Kirk even says at some point, or somebody says, like, we're not your enemy. You're not our enemy. Like, you weren't cast out. 5,000 years ago, ancestors of yours were cast out. And apparently ancestors of ours 5,000 years ago had the technology to banish you from this area. But, like, but kind of like a, let's put the past behind us and just start fresh. You can have any planets that are uninhabited, you know, like around here, like we can be friends and we can all, can't we all just get along kind of thing. And even Zenner's kind of, he's not necessarily coming around to it. He's like, well, I mean, this is our mission. Like, we're here and we're here to stay. Like, I'm, you know, whatever. Garamanis wants to kill all of you or, you know, get you off of your planets because he thinks they're ours. And I just want this 5,000-year-old wound to finally heal.
And he also at one point, I think, basically says, I don't mind if we have to go to war. I just, you guys have become friends, so I don't want to kill you guys.
Yeah, I don't want to go to war with you.
it's almost like he is like, he's so determined to prove Garamanis wrong just so that he can be friends with and continue to be friends with the Federation.
Yeah. And that's why too, when Kirk and, well, it's when Spock and actually even McCoy was kind of one of the ones that came up with who these people were. And they know the truth. It almost makes you feel bad because it's like, oh crap. Like, well, first of all, we can't let them take over Earth and all these alpha and beta quadrant species or whatever. But we, like, holding back the truth from them of like, hey, so you're kind of big in this mythology of, you know, our history base, and figure out that Garamanis was actually right. And then Garamanis actually dies, you know, for his cause. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like, oh man, like this is like, towards the end of the book, I was really siding to some extent with like Zenner and the Furies.
Oh, you totally empathize with him. You empathize with the three different sides. You have the Furies who are now just like going full scorched earth. You have the Klingons who have been like, we've been telling you, you should do this. And then you have the Federation who's just finally realizing, all right, we're going to have to fight these guys. And you kind of empathize with all of them. And clearly Zenner becomes a villain. He's not the villain at the beginning, but he becomes that villain. And yet he's still a villain that you can understand, you empathize with, but you don't want him to win. We certainly aren't like, right, you know, you guys should totally wipe out the Federation. We don't go that far, but we go far enough to be like, I get it.
Yeah.
I understand. And I that's excellent writing on Diane Carey's part.
Yeah.
Also, when Kellen goes and murders,
oh my gosh,
the Federation, first he murders a Federation person security and guard, murders, yeah, security guard, and murders a member of the Furies. And both actions, to me, were just heartbreaking because I was like, come on, man, I thought you were a different type of Klingon. And it's one of those when you think someone's different and then they just confirm your worst suspicions about them, and you're just like, man, I thought you were a good one, and you just feel so hard. Like, it was, if any other Klingon kills, kills, you know, our own, one of our own crew, I'd be like, what are y'all idiots doing letting him on, letting him be near one of our crew members or something. But when Kellen did it, I was like, ah.
Yeah, it was hard because, like, when he killed the security guard at first, I mean, it came out of nowhere. I mean, it was just like, boom. I'm just like, oh my gosh. And it doesn't, it's funny because, like, by the time we get to the end of the book, it doesn't really feel out of character for Kellen, even though what we've come to kind of like him and everything, like, because he's kind of the zealot in this case, for this particular cause. But yeah, like, it was like shocking when he killed that security guard. But then when he went after the Fury, that was gruesome for a Star Trek book. It was like just the fact that he used his, you know, dagger, and that he like that the it's kind of like, why won't you die? And, you know, like kind of just was basically having to saw through him and to the point where he cuts the guy's head off to kill him. And it was just like, dang. And then actually, man, there's actually some good emotional pieces in this book, because then not long after that, you know, McCoy, trying to do the right thing, is like, no, I didn't want to do an autopsy because I don't know what their practices are. In fact, I really didn't want to do much at all with the body. But I tore apart this doll that he was carrying on him, and then to find out that that was like their soul, essentially, like that, that was kind of like what their beliefs were. And McCoy would have been better just to slice up the body and leave the doll alone. And just the way that he was written was heartbreaking too, because it was like McCoy felt so, he was like, I don't know what to do. Like, there's nothing I can do. And now I want to make it right, but I don't know if there's anything I can do that makes it right. Like, it was just like,
and then they say, there is something you can do to make it right. Yeah. He's like, no, that's not what I meant.
No, yeah. You must die.
Yeah. I almost wanted to see if Spock could mind meld with the doll, and I was like, I want to see if this works. We did not get to see that.
I'm actually also, now that you say that, I'm actually surprised that he didn't mind meld with like Zenner or Garamanis or something throughout the book, just to get like to have Spock know exactly who they were, to then like kind of put the final nail in it, like, no, these people are bad people and we've got to fight them tooth and nail.
There was a little piece of the book, and it's really, you know, it's very small and it's very kind of a light subject, but I thought it was relatable and hilarious and delightful, which is that like Kellen has, the general has like one science officer that he knows, which is the officer Aragorn. And so he constantly refers to Aragorn and is like, Aragorn, you be the one to look this up. And it's like, you know, you have a scientist, like a science officer on your ship, Kellen. Yeah. And he opens up a channel to the other ship so that he could talk to his to the person he trusts and knows. Yeah. And then at one point he kind of makes Aragorn in charge of one of the other ships and kind of makes him the acting commodore or something when he's gone. And it's just such a relatable thing that when someone comes into an organization and they're from the outside, there's like that one person they know, they put all their trust and they kind of lean heavily on that one person that they know. Because they know they can trust that person. And so that was a very, and it was kind of funny every time he would go do it. And that's a little touch of Diane Carey throwing something in that isn't important to the plot, but makes it lived in, realistic, and also makes you empathize more with Kellen.
Yeah.
Because you're like, I would probably do the same thing.
Well, and Kirk was doing the same thing even when Spock was incapacitated. He was still relying on Spock. Else. Yeah, he's got other people. Like, he put Chekhov on the science station and then had to kind of tell this other navigator, like, you know, Chekhov is busy doing what he's trying to take over for Spock, even though we know he's like, no, he's not. Like, Spock is still doing Spock's thing and just from sickbay. And, like, Scotty helped him out with that. But, you know, Kirk is still on his own bridge contacting sickbay to talk to Spock, even though he's got perfectly qualified people around him, just not the same people. And then it Kirk later has, and I thought this was really well done too, has the realization that when I think like Sulu is incapacitated at some point, so then a crew member has to take over for him, like during the battle, and Kirk had to be like, okay, well, and tells the guy, like, you know what, you're the person for this, you have to do this, and everybody does things a little bit differently, and you have to be okay with that, I have to be okay with that, Sulu's gonna have to be okay with that when he reads about this in the reports later or whatever, but like, and you know, we finally, like, Kirk finally gets that realization, like, I've got people that are good and can do their jobs, they may not be the way I'm gonna do them or that I'm used to people doing them, but I just have to let it happen. And I thought that was a really good character moment for Kirk, and that, you know, then mirrored what Kellen was doing earlier in the book, that just another kind of just small through line that worked throughout.
There's also something that Kirk does, well, I should say that Diane Carey does, that is really, I really like, which is she has Kirk tell the crew, we're going to switch over. All right, you guys have been on duty for so long. We're going to have you guys switch. And then he goes to the command deck during the middle of this kind of battle stuff happening. And he doesn't switch over because they're in the middle of this stuff. And he basically is like, look, guys, I know you guys have been on duty for a long time. But until we're done, until we're out of red alert or yellow alert or whatever it was, We're gonna stay on in your positions because I don't want someone else taking over the helm that's not been doing it now. And that is a very relatable thing that happens in the military, happens in real sea voyages and stuff, but also like happens at work. Like I'm a teacher. There's times where, especially when I was teaching elementary, where I'd been watching the kids for so long and I was ready and my shift should have been over, but because either the replacement teacher or the replacement person, adults hadn't shown up, or because something was happening and they needed extra hands, whatever, I just had to grin and bear it and keep working. So it's a very, again, relatable sequence that isn't necessarily integral to the plot, but makes the world feel realistic.
I almost wish, now that you say that it was like the gamma shift or whatever that was on when that happened, so that like Sulu and Chekhov could have shown up and were like ready to take over, and Kirk telling them, "No, we're in the middle of battle. I've got these ones going." I think that would have
worked even better.
Yeah,
but there were like red shirts that were ready to be relieved, and he was basically like, "All right, you the red shirt stays."
I thought Sulu was there.
That he's there, oh, he's one but of he's them, not yeah. the only. He's one the of them. Only, yeah. It's like it's the whole crew.
Yeah,
that it affects.
Yeah, and I mean those ones were like on deck ready when somebody was taken out or whatever. But
also something we've not talked about, I laughed so hard at the Scotty scene.
Oh yeah,
where he calls it Scotty and he's expecting Scotty to A, know all about this like history, and B, to be like believing in it and stuff, because that is such a Star Trek thing to do.
Yeah.
Like if this was Chakotay, they'd be like, oh yes, in Native American lore we have this thing and I totally believe in it and I'm going to tell you how to get out of it.
Yeah.
Scotty's like, This is the lore. I don't know about it, and it's stupid.
Yeah, he's like, well, and he even asks about, he's like, what? Are you only asking me because I'm Scottish?
Because I'm Scottish?
It's like, and they're like, I mean, yeah.
And he kind of has that, can I please go back to my actual job now? Like, please let me be done.
He was like so uncomfortable.
That was hilarious. Like, it's not jokes in that, but it was hilarious sequence.
Yeah.
And it was really short, but it was memorable.
Yeah, and I mean, it worked for the scene because it was, it's a heavy book. And that scene was where they were kind of figuring out, at least the seeds were planted of discovering who the Furies were and everything. And so then because Scotty didn't really have much to do in this book, so it was a nice way to just to bring him in. It didn't take anything away from the plot. In fact, it just furthered it a little bit because he was, in the end, out of all that, if she's like, what, you think I know all this because I'm Scottish? Well, here's what I do know. And it was, more than you would expect after that. But yeah, I from some of the books that we've read, and like the Gateways ones, and actually Matt and I had read through the New Earth books a couple years ago, and she's got a couple in that series, and that was a tough series to get through. It's kind of one of those things where it's like it wasn't necessarily badly written; it was just like hard. It was too hard of sci-fi for Star Trek and everything. But this is, and there was actually quite a bit of science in this book too, with like the whole like mass drop and all that stuff. But this was just a really good Star Trek story where the Star Trek crew was trying too hard to have the Star Trek message when the message was really like, no, we need to fight these people, and just, almost showing our Star Trek characters holding their Federation values to a fault.
Yeah, and, it has complex ideas that fit in Star Trek that challenge traditional Star Trek ideals without being, without feeling like she's spitting on anyone. She's not, she's challenging traditional Star Trek ideas without trying to degrade what's come before. It is a very hard thing to tightrope. And she did well on all of that. And it's one of those, Star Trek inherently was not, at least in, you know, it wasn't as these action naval battle stuff until the motion picture era.
Yeah.
But there's still a lot of science. So she balances the science parts of the story that we sometimes get, especially like Next Gen. She's balancing the action of the motion picture, the characters of the Klingons, but it's still works in the TOS time frame. Like, there's so much balancing that had to happen for this book to work right. Yeah. If anything was unbalanced, it would have either been cheesy, or it wouldn't have fit in Star Trek, or it would have been boring, or it would have been too much action. Like, that's also something, is that despite how much action in here, it's not too much.
Yeah.
It's just about the right amount. If you cut some of the action, it probably wouldn't have worked as well. And if you added a little bit, I'd be like, all right,
yeah.
Let's go back to character stuff. So it's perfectly balanced.
Yeah. And it's that typical length of a Star Trek book from this era. It's 289 pages. The font size is respectable. It's, you know, like, it was just and her being one of the co-creators of this saga, I mean, obviously she understood the assignment because she helped write it. But, you know, as far as, I mean, the last lines of the book, you know, is Zenner sending a message to the other side, you know, it's kind of like the Borg in Star Trek First Contact or whatever. Or no, it was...
It's not a First Contact. I know what you're talking about. It's... is it Q Who? Or... Something the one where like we that. Meet them and they're like, we're going to like let the others know. Yeah. Okay, now we need to go.
And we're going
to
head over there now. I mean, in First Contact, they were trying to send a message to the Delta Quadrant. That was kind of part of the battle on the deflector dish. But anyways, Zenner here sends a message to what we're presuming to be the Delta Quadrant. And the message that we find out in the very end of the way the book ends is, the Battle of Garamanis is lost. We have not survived, but this is our rightful place. Try again. And it's just like that perfect, like, to be continued, you know,
that
like to,
is, yeah,
you know, to like be like, oh my gosh, I got to get into the next book to find out what happens, because we know it doesn't take place for another 70, 80 years. And, you know, and actually I also appreciate, I mean, the way that they tried to do gateways with like having a cliffhanger that then gets resolved later. I'm so glad they hadn't thought of that yet, because this book, it's also just like, you know, having something happen where then we don't get a conclusion until we've read the rest of the stories. Like, I think this works just so well, having this as a standalone TOS story. I mean, even just if you read this book and didn't read any of the others, this is a great book, I think.
Absolutely. And it works because it's a universe. The cliffhanger is for our universe. All of our main characters will continue going on their lives, and for most of them, they won't even be alive when the next part of the invasion happens. So we don't need anything further there. Where even when the next book starts, it's going to be kind of starting over. It's going to be its own kind of standalone in a way. Universally it's connecting, but it's also going to be kind of standalone, but it, you know, thematically. And I assume we'll see, I would hope that we'll see some of the Klingon characters again, because Klingons can live 150 years, but even if we don't, I think it'll be okay, because we've kind of paid off what we needed to pay off in this book.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I mean, I would guess that, yeah, something is going to happen and somebody's going to have this, like Picard's going to be like, gee, I remember something from history about this. And, you know, they're going to look in the records or whatever and see that the original Enterprise dealt with these aliens before or whatever. But, you know, it's what I'm hoping for is like these theories in this book were not super villainous. I mean, they were in some ways in what their mission was, but we befriended Zenner. We wanted to kind of root for him some. I don't think that's going to be the case going forward. In fact, I think it's going to be even worse, because now they've gotten the message from Zenner who his people probably know was an agnostic,
right,
as far as these beliefs were. And for him to then say, nope, you know, kind of like you said earlier, he's a converted zealot now who's dying and sending his dying message to, like, we're dying, but you need to come now. And so I think that, like, all I'm hoping for is just epic battles, confrontations, you know, with our characters, you know, throughout the other series.
Now, when it came to Gateways, the best of, at least to me, the best of the Gateways books was the one written by the co-creator of the Gateways, Robert Greenberger.
Right.
He wrote the third one, which was the next gen one. And I think it's because he got to write the events that were the most important. Mm-hmm. And he was the one who created the series, so he understood the assignment. Whereas I'm hoping that that's not the case here, that, you know, Diane Carey is the co-creator of this series. She's already written book one. And so I'm hoping that that's not the case where we're just getting the best book already because the other authors won't know the assignment. And having read, I think I've only read one, Kristen Catherine Rush and Dean Wesley Smith. I've only read one of their books, but it was a Klingon-related book, and it worked out pretty well. So I'm hoping that they understand the assignment with the next one.
Yeah, and I would hope so too, and I would think so, because they both were also very prolific authors back in this time.
Yes, they were.
I'm really excited to get into the rest of the books of this series, just because, you know, we're getting into just some of, like, L.A. Graff has written, you know, those folks have written like a dozen or more, actually, novels. And then Dean Wesley Smith and Christine Catherine Rush wrote a lot together.
Yep.
And then Dean Wesley Smith has even done some things by himself. And then Daffodab, he wrote not as many as them, but, like, he was fairly prolific, or was, you know, starting to gain prolificity. I don't know, whatever that, he was starting anyway,
yeah.
We're just making up words, but I'm excited for what could come. Like, we started off strong, you know, like, there can only go down from here, which I hope it doesn't. So yeah,
that would be amazing if it doesn't.
I'm looking forward to it. I don't know if we even need to ask, but do you have any final thoughts, or, like, what's your rating for this book?
Something I don't get to say often, but I'm so happy I get to say here. I'm going to give this a full 5 out of 5. Like, literally, as just an individual book, it's going to go up there among my favorite Star Trek books. And as I'm thinking about it, I'm like, if this series holds up, it's going to be a favorite. Like, not my number one, but it's going to be among my top favorites.
Yeah, I agree. It's definitely a 5-star book for me as well. Like, this, it's funny, there wasn't a lot of nostalgia for me reading this, because I just don't, like, I read this so long ago that, like, probably 20 plus years ago, I just don't remember much from it, except that when I used to have, like, a couple hundred Star Trek books, and just never was, I wasn't reading them, and I was, like, not much of a reader at the time anyway. So I ended up getting rid of the majority of them, which I kind of kick myself about now.
Yeah.
But when they sat in storage for, like, 6 or 7 years, it was like, okay, why am I holding on to these? But I did hang on to a few of them. And these four books were ones that I kept because I remembered enjoying them. So, so while there wasn't, like, any nostalgia reading this and remembering what I'd read before, I'm just glad to have a memory that these were good, I guess, and that being held up by this reading.
There is a phenomenon of where the first of a series you read is oftentimes, like, your favorites in it, because it's, like, that thing that got you into it. And to an extent, for me, that's true. But then there's also the phenomena of, well, the most recent thing you read might be a favorite because it's the most recent thing you read. And I have a feeling that this is going to be one of those books where it's not, you know, years down the line, I do believe this is going to hold up and it's going to continue to be a favorite, even though it's not a first or a last.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. This is just, it's a good Star Trek book, and it's a good beginning to what could be a pretty epic crossover series. Well, I am so excited next time we get to talk about the next book in this series, which is Star Trek The Next Generation, number 41, Invasion, book 2, The Soldiers of Fear by Dean Wesley Smith and Christine Catherine Rush.
I'm very excited for this one, and it won't be terribly long, hopefully, for us to at least when we're recording this, to read it. We're going to read it pretty soon.
Yep.
Because we have an author interview we have to do immediately after.
Yes, yeah, we got new Star Trek books coming out, and get back to these ones. Yeah, can't, like, good times coming up. Can't wait for it.
Absolutely.
Well, Jonathan, when you're not invading space to take over what you feel like is rightfully yours, where can people find you?
You can find me on YouTube. That's my main thing for talking about books. Just search Jonathan Cohn, K-O-A-N. And you can also find my Twitter, where recently I've been talking about NASA stuff, also at Jonathan Cohn. And I'm on Facebook and Goodreads, although I don't check our groups there as much. But, you know, I am there.
Yes. Yes, and you can find my YouTube channel at Bookbuster Reviews. I forgot it for a second.
You had to remember it.
It's been a while since I've been to it. It's within the next month, that's going to be changing. But yes, you can find my YouTube channel at Bookbuster Reviews, and you can find me on Goodreads and Facebook in the Babel Conference. I did actually just update the Facebook group, so it's got these Invasion books in there. I actually should put Dayton's book that's coming out in the on the shelf in there too. So I mean, it's pretty easy. Just look up Star Trek Invasion. That's what we're reading for the next few months. But yeah, look forward to talking to people online. And if you've read this book or this series in the past, like, this is an oldie but a goodie. We'd love to hear from you. You know, in the Babel Conference, tell us what you thought. What are your memories of this? Did you hate it? And did we convince you otherwise? Let us know.
Thank you for listening. And until next time, live long
and read on.
What do you call that, light reading?
To each his own, number one.